call?
Maybe it's a sign. I mean,
yeah.
Not that I'm aware of.
And he's not linked in on this. He doesn't want to do anything. Okay.
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. That looks good, actually.
Yeah. We're recording. All we'll need to do is hit broadcast, and then we'll start. So I'll be here for a
good.
I'll just get water. 1 second. Almost.
Is Lisa actually going? Is she going to try and log in?
As a participant. As a what do you call? Maybe she'll come as
participant. Yeah.
Participant.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Right.
This is done. I think we should close the door here.
Yeah. Yeah, I closed my door as well, just in case somebody goes in there.
So I was thinking, just so the audio is nice and clear, are you going to kind of do a little intro to go over the basics?
Yeah, so what I would suggest is you mute that one, I use my one.
Exactly.
We're talking.
Finally, old machine. So when it's time to do that, just like give me an elbow, I'll mute this one. Yeah. Once you get to that part, I'll unmute it, and then I'll be able to.
Hey, Murray, I was reading a Baldacci fiction last week, and it starts out with a whole bunch of stuff in Glasgow and then moves to Edinburgh.
Oh, really?
And I had, this is actually published in 2008, but still, he was making all sorts of comparisons between the two cities. I didn't realize that Glasgow was so much larger than Edinburgh.
Oh, yeah, by several.
Yeah.
Edinburgh's quite, small contained city.
Edinburgh's pretty, Glasgow's big.
Yeah, we often remind them of that as well. Richard knows that that's how I get all my, that's how I get all my international assignments is that I was able to move from Glasgow to Edinburgh successfully.
That's right.
Yeah,
you hit all the real hot spots in Great Britain, Glasgow, Edinburgh, Liverpool.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
No, that's you were in London. You were in London.
I was in London. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have to say, every constituency that I've ever lived in the UK voted to remain in Europe. So.
Wow.
Yeah. So there. Yeah. I do get to vote. I also get to vote December 12th. I'm pretty happy about that.
You do.
Yeah. You get to vote for. I got for 15 years, unless I go back within the 15 years and go permanent, for 15 years I can vote in, I have to vote in Liverpool Riverside constituency. But they just sent me my reminder, with the other day. They do it by email. It's quite interesting.
But do you vote by
postal vote? Yeah.
Post.
Yeah.
Okay. Italy's like that. I received the.
You confirm it.
For a local?
They confirm. You can do all your registration by email. PDF and then
we can pre-vote by mail or absentee ballot. I got to say, with all the shenanigans going on with voting, both of those things, I worry whether or not anybody really counts them.
I'm told that actually in a close vote, the party watchers, that's what they go for. If it's not a close vote, it's actually true that a They sometimes in some constituencies they won't open it, but seemingly that's what they really go for in a close vote. Is the first thing they do is open all the postal votes. And,
showing up, y'all know we're going to go live in 30 seconds.
30 seconds. Okay.
Okay.
Right. So you're on first, and then me. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then Richard, and then me. Yeah, good.
All right. So if you're going to start, I'm going to go ahead and mute that. We'll wait a minute or two.
Where does it say if anybody's signed on?
Yeah. Okay, so I can. All right. Now it's okay? Yeah. No, I can put my sound here so it actually will use this sound here. We solved the echo. Okay, so welcome to another webinar from the Management Education Development Division of the Academy of Management, hosted by the Merrick School of Business here at University of Baltimore. I am Eusebio Scornavaca, Parsons Professor of Digital Innovation. Before we introduce our guest, I will give some guidelines of how the seminar is going to work. We have two tools that you can use. One is the Q&A, where you can post your questions as we go. Richard will be able to answer them in different moments. There will be an exercise that Richard will be doing, and then we use the chat function. So please make sure if you just want to make comments or things in general, use the chat. If you're going to ask specific questions regarding the presentation, please use the Q&A function, which is right there in the bottom of your screen. If there are any issues regarding technology or so forth, please use the chat function, and I'll be able to see here and assist with that. We wait a couple minutes because I can see here at the moment there is a constant number of people signing in. I would suggest we give it a couple minutes before passing on to our Dean of the Merrick School of Business, Murray Diao, to introduce our guest, and then we can start the seminar. So just stay with us for just a minute or two that we make sure that we have everybody on board, and then we can proceed.
Gives more time to further the question.
Okay. So, you're live now.
Okay. Well, welcome. I'm Murray Diao. I'm the Dean of the Merrick School of Business, and I want to welcome you on behalf both of the Merrick School of Business and the Management Education Division of AIM to what has now become a regular webcast. We're really grateful for the opportunity to do this and to bring some of our greatest influencers to have discussions with us. So It's really my great honor today, really, to introduce our speaker, Richard Biatsis. Richard and I have actually known each other for many years, and I just completed reading his book on helping others, coaching for compassion, that he's going to, I think, talk about in this webinar. And there is an exercise in that book where you're actually asked to think about someone who's been an important mentor to you in your career. So I actually did that exercise, and I chose Richard. And Richard, I think, as you'll see, has got, for me, has sort of stepped in as a real person who really bridges both practice and scholarship. That he used to teach me that, you know, practitioners ask the question, what and how, and scholars ask the question, why. But really what unites them both is that we need evidence. And evidence-based research management has really been Richard's calling card. Of course, his intentional change theory, which he's been publishing about for over 20 years, is a framework that he's used both to understand individuals, teams, organizations, and indeed, you know, whole communities. Richard is the distinguished university professor at Case Western Reserve University. He's a professor in the departments of organizational behavior, psychology, cognitive science. He's the H.R. Horvitz Professor of Family Business. He also has a chair at a SADE in Barcelona. Originally started off his career in aeronautics and astronautics at MIT. And then he has a MS and then a PhD in social psychology from Harvard University. He's published over 200 articles. He's classified twice by SHRM as a influential thinker of the year. His courses, his MOOCs rather, in Coursera have attracted over a million enrollees from about over 200 countries. And he has nine books, of which the latest, as I mentioned, is the Helping People Change, Coaching with Compassion for Lifelong Learning and Growth, which he wrote with Melvin Smith and Ellen Van Houston. So I'm going to turn it over then to Richard. Richard's going to take us through the webinar. As I say, just remind you what, if you came in late, if you want to ask questions, please use the Q&A feature. And if you get any technical issues, also use the Q&A. Because, sorry. If you've got questions, use the Q&A button. I'm a dean. I have to follow instructions closely. If you have questions, use the Q&A. Richard is going to do an exercise later on in this, and you'll use the chat button for that. If you do have any technical issues, please use the chat button because we're monitoring that, okay? So thank you. Richard, welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Murray. It indeed has been a long time. I think you and I first met in 1977, excuse me. And then we started working together right away. Also, thank you, Eusebio, and also Lisa for pulling this together, inviting me to have this opportunity to talk to folks, both that are involved in your school at the University of Baltimore, but also in the MED division at AOM. What I want to talk about today are some of the key ideas that we've put forth in our new book, Helping People Change, which really is a synthesis of the last 30 years of specific studies we've been doing at Case Western Reserve University on coaching. But more importantly for me, this is a lifelong, career-long passion. The very first study I did in psychology, when I was contemplating what to do because I'd gone out and worked as an aerospace researcher and found it a little boring in 1966 and 67. The first study was on how, in this case, graduate students at MIT helped each other or didn't. So for the better part of 53 years, I've been puzzling about this and trying to go at it in different ways. So let me share a number of these observations with you. First, life is all about change. If we don't change, we die. And therefore, change is life. But it's not just any change, because deterioration can also be a form of change. We're talking about positive adaptation, innovation. And to do that, we have to be open to possibilities. And that's where we have to be open to not just possibility of changing, but to learning. But this becomes stressful in two levels. One, it's stressful to give up what you know and what you currently do and believe in, your habits. It's also stressful to be the helper, whether the helper is a formal coach or a teacher, a manager, a cleric, a therapist, or a parent. And because you're in a position of responsibility, you have what Dave McClellan started calling in the early 70s, we have a lot of power stress. So the dilemma is, when we are trying to help someone, we're having to wrestle with our own degree of psychophysiological dynamics, but also, how do we reach the other person? And we have to face the fact that at this level of stress that we often get accustomed to, we somehow cope with, but it's not healthy. Our bodies weren't designed for this level of stress. We actually have, most of us suffer from varying degrees of strain. And at this level, because of the annoying stress, I'm not talking about acute stressors, the annoying stress, we actually have cognitive and perceptual and emotional impairment. I'll say more about the details later. So what I'm going to do today is to talk about what we've learned and how it affects those of us who want to work with students, clients, patients, subordinates, or family members. And it really is based on 39 different longitudinal behavioral studies, 3 fMRI studies, and 2 hormonal studies. Let me start with the story of Aaron Benet. Aaron was in kindergarten, and as a 5-year-old, Aaron was asked, like the rest of his class, to draw a picture of a house. And on the upper left-hand corner, you see the picture of the house that most of the children drew. And on the right side of it, you see the picture that Aaron drew. Then later on in class, the teacher said, draw a picture of an airplane. Again, you see what most of the kids drew, the kind of image, and to the right what Aaron drew. A few weeks later, the teacher, the head psychologist for the school system, and the principal of this elementary school called Aaron's parents in. They thought they were coming in for a typical teacher-parent conference. When they got in, the teacher started by showing these two drawings and explaining that there have been a number of things happening with Aaron where he's become increasingly more withdrawn. He seems to be difficult and resist messages from the teacher. And then there were these drawings, which the experts all interpreted as indications of some deeper emotional disturbance. They wanted to know how conditions were at home. Did they think Aaron felt safe? Was there a conflict at home? Now, his parents had no idea this was coming. I mean, to them, Aaron was a normal 5-year-old kid bouncing off the walls and the furniture and playing and laughing and doing all the things 9-year-old boys do. And they were absolutely shocked. So right away, they reacted with a certain amount of defensiveness, and they got into the discussion. And as it emerged, the teacher and the principal and the chief psychologist of the school system, chief counselor, were not going to budge. And in fact, they said they had already made a decision that Aaron had to go into special ed. And his parents reacted to that. They didn't really want it. They know how difficult it is for a young person who's somewhat sensitive to a lot sensitive about what others think to be pulled out and put into this group that still has a social stigma. And finally, the school people just said, look, if you don't want to do it, fine, but you have to take your kid out of Aaron out of the school system. We are not going to be responsible for him. This is a public school. So both of them are feeling very dejected, beaten, and they go home. And they're holding Aaron's two drawings with them. They walk in the front door, and Aaron's still awake, and he sees his two drawings, and he says, "Oh, you have my drawings. Isn't that great?" And his mother and father smiled at him and says, "Yes, Aaron, we're very excited to have your drawings, and we want to talk about them." And so they sat down on the couch, put the drawings, his two drawings, in front of them on the coffee table. And his father, who had some training in internal consulting in a large company, turns to him and he says, "Aaron, your mother and I love these drawings." And then he points to the one of the house and he says, "Tell me what you see. Tell me what you drew." So Aaron then goes and looks at the vertical lines and he says, "Well, every house has to have pipes that move water up to each of the bathrooms and bring the toilet water and things, the waste, down." He said, "And then every floor in the house has to have electrical wires so that people can plug in their iPhones and their toasters and televisions." And his parents are smiling at this point, somewhat surprised. And then his father points to the picture of the airplane and says, "Aaron, tell me about this." He said, "Oh, it's a picture of an airplane. And the line that I drew," and he motions up and down, he said, "that's the fuel lines, because airplanes store their fuel in the wings, and that's where the wings are, and that allows the plane to get the fuel it needs." And then he shows the horizontal lines, and he said, "And these are the control cables that an airplane needs so that the pilot can adjust the wings and move them in ways to keep the plane flying and flying in the right direction." His parents are sitting there, mouth agape, because these aren't stick drawings of a potential indication of psychosis. These are drawings of a potential engineer or architect. And the fact that the teacher didn't mention that part of why Aaron has been resisting is he's left-handed, and she believes children should be right-handed, so she kept haranguing him to write and do things with his right hand. And as a result, after arguing about it for a while, he finally gave up and started to withdraw. It took his parents 3 years before they could get Aaron out of special ed and back into a regular track. And all of that was because nobody in the classroom thought to ask Aaron what he was drawing. No one thought to ask him what he was seeing. And I start with this because the simple issue of listening to others sounds easy enough, but how often do we as professors assume that when somebody walks into a classroom that they want to take our course? Assumes that they're there not for show or for some social media purposes, but that they actually care about the material. How often do we assume a client wants to improve their performance or a subordinate, when most of us know if you're over 35, you don't want to improve your performance every day at work? So what happens is the simple act of asking somebody ends up being a profound image into one of the basic issues that haunts us in every attempt at helping. Now, I can go into a lot of the logic and spew a whole bunch of statistics, but 65 years of research in social psychology has told us that people don't get convinced of things by rational arguments. They get convinced by emotional arguments and use rational arguments to make themselves feel better. So what I'd like to do right now is an exercise. I'd like you to, and see if you can grab a piece of paper and a pen or a pencil, and write the names of people who have helped you the most in your life. Now think about your whole life, not just work. In a sense, answer the question, "I wouldn't be who I am today if it wasn't for person X, or I wouldn't be where I am today for person Y." So who has helped you in your life become, who's helped you the most in your life, the several people, become who you are, get to where you are? I'll go silent for about 20, 25 seconds and let you reflect and think of a few names. Now what I'd like you to do is go back to the first name you put on the list and think of a moment you had with them in which you learned something important. Now, if you think about your, if you put down the, you know, your mother, your father, you probably had hundreds of those moments, but let your memory have one pop into awareness. And next to their name, write a few words or phrases that remind you about, you know, you're playing the video of that moment in your mind. Write a few words or phrases to describe what that person said or did in that moment. Now, I'll give you longer to do this. I'll go silent for at least 30 seconds. I apologize, interrupting reflections. You can still keep making notes for yourself. What I'd like to do is invite some of you who already have written some things down to using the chat box to share some of your observations as to what the person said or did in that moment. And then, Eusebio, I assume that I'll read it out loud to everybody so they could hear it, right? Okay.
Correct.
Non-judgmental, open-hearted, bringing out your own wisdom. They ask questions and listened intently to what they had to say. They gave you insights into yourself, taught you the value of hard work, showed you how to be a good person, compassionate. They treated you as an equal. They recognized something valuable about you. They talked about being honest, always being honest. They thought about, they asked you a question about what have you considered, in this case, majoring in a particular field of accounting. They spoke truth and wisdom. They provided observations about the rationale that might have been going on in their behavior and yours. They guided you through an experiment in the lab and asked you what you noticed, asking the questions along the way. They had a holding space that was filled with love and acceptance and patience, and they believed in you. I'm not exactly sure what this means, but one person wrote in that they eyeballed you. I assume that means looking at you directly, but advised you in a caring way. They had some honest and tough feedback. They encouraged you to do something new, empowered you, modeled being good at helping others. They communicated their constant support no matter what you did. Talking about their confidence in my abilities and who I am. They stayed calm, encouragement, validation. They loved your writing, and so you since became a writer. And acknowledged your ideas, in this case for a dissertation, was valid. They shared the observation that less is more, that not everybody can be everything, and that hard work and play hard, work hard, and have some patience and don't get greedy, spotted potential, encouraged. They had a lot of faith in you. These are great. Now, let me ask you a different question, but about the same thing. So as you're remembering these people, these moments, as you're moving back into the memory, how does it make you feel? Not what are you analyzing, but how does it make you feel? Important and loved? Cared about, supported, thankful, accepted and appreciated, respected, supported, empowered, seen, worthy? Made you feel inspired and even more confident? Made you feel capable, heard, listened to, special, responsible, safe, confident, trusted, appreciated, empowered, made you feel as there were unlimited possibilities, curious, loved, valued, unique, inspired. This is a really moving list. I have done this exercise on all seven continents, yes, including Antarctica, about 65 countries, and whether we're in Astana, Kazakhstan, or Milano, or here in the US, one of the things that is really amazing is how people tend to answer in a very similar way. Most people, like many of you, said that they felt loved, supported, they felt amazingly appreciated, they appreciated the care, and they felt very grateful for what the person was offering them. As many of you said, you felt inspired and empowered. Nobody here said serene or centered, but I had a group of folks, leaders in hospitals yesterday in Chicago, talking about that. So first, let me point out that, you know, in this world of mindfulness as important, you just talked about a number of key feelings. And if you had any of those that I mentioned, you felt grateful, thankful, loved, you felt empowered or serene, you just had about 5 minutes in the parasympathetic nervous system. You just had what in our jargon is called a renewal moment. Because when you activate the parasympathetic nervous system, it's the only thing your body can do for your body, mind, and heart to allow you to overcome. It's the only natural antidote to stress. And by the way, I'd suggest if you haven't talked to that person lately that you consider giving them a call. Just don't email. Call maybe this weekend and say, hey, I was thinking of you. And sadly, if they've passed away, spend some time Saturday morning with a cup of tea or coffee, remembering key moments with them. It's a very special gift. The most important question I'm going to ask you in this webinar, we're actually not going to analyze, but I want to toss out there for you to think about later this evening. Whose list will you be on? Whose list will you be on? Because, you know, there's only two ways in life to have a legacy. One is to donate money to a really good university. I actually am paid to say that. But seriously, the only way to have a legacy in life is through our relationships. I used to say through the people that you've touched, but now HR people have gotten so finicky about this, I can't use that expression. So let me just suggest our legacy in life is through our relationships. So now let's go to the analysis part of this. Okay. So, as Murray started to suggest in his introduction, I started working on an early version of this theory with Dave Cole back in 1967, in the spring of 67. And what we started on was a quest to see if we could figure out what accounted for change, what accounted for sustained change, something that lasts more than just a few weeks. And over the decades, it's morphed a little bit. Now, since 2000, I've called it intentional change theory. But it starts with a premise, whether I was spending time in the 70s working with alcoholics and drug addicts or leaders in the 80s or looking at graduate students since 87 from 25 to 65-year-olds, it's very clear that when individuals change, you need complexity theory to appreciate it because almost all change is both nonlinear and discontinuous. So it happens in fits and starts. And in fact, although I'd been studying nonlinear dynamics for quite a while from 1964 all the way through, but it was in 1977 or 78, Murray, that you had brought me this new field called catastrophe theory. And it was beyond nonlinear dynamics. It actually was the forerunner of complexity theory. But in those days, people were using it to try to understand everything from meteorological and climate change to economic shifts. And it was actually pivotal in embracing the whole dynamic of why I was watching some people able to deal with alcoholism or drug addiction and other people not, most people not. But over the decades, and in talking with other people who have done this kind of research, it becomes very clear that amid all of the things that happen to people, those who sustainably change have five experiences which seem to be, in complexity terms, a moment of emergence where something pops into your awareness. The first one is the red oval, the ideal self, where a person gets an image of the person they would love to be, something they want out of life. This is beyond goals. This is a dream. And if you have that, you have either a part of or a whole vision, you're eligible for the second. Because it turns out that if you actually look at actual data, not manufactured questionnaire data, but actual behavior, almost nothing in human behavior is distributed on a normal distribution. It's almost all distributed according to a Taylor series or power curve. That means that if you don't have some vision, the likelihood of you getting to the second discovery is about 5%, not a 50% chance. The second discovery is who you are in terms of how you come across to others. Who you are in terms of thinking about yourself is so delusional. I don't think it really matters except in coaching, but what you want to know for this purpose is how does the person come across, and the instantaneous result comparing to the ideal self of a personal balance sheet. The third discovery ends up being a learning agenda, something you would love to do. This is not a performance improvement plan. The fourth is the experimentation and practice with the new thoughts, feelings, and behavior. And the fifth is this core set of trusting, caring relationships that moves you through all of these changes. Now, what does this have to do with the exercise we just did? I believe inside of each one of us, we have, again, in complexity theory terms, a positive and a negative emotional attractor. By the way, since my theory is also a fractal and operates the same at levels of teams, organizations, communities, and countries, I believe these two attractors exist in every human system. But let's stay at the individual level for now. And these are, by the way, technically Lorentz attractors. They are strange attractors. The positive emotional attractor is being in the parasympathetic nervous system and activating the empathic network in your brain. I'll explain each of these in a little more detail in a few moments. Being in the negative emotional attractor is being in the stress response, the sympathetic nervous system, and being in the analytic network in your brain. The PEA, as I call it, is thinking positive thoughts. The NEA is thinking negative. It's the difference between thinking about possibilities versus problems, dreams versus expectations, optimism versus pessimism, which I love because optimists call themselves optimists. What do pessimists call themselves? Yeah, you're all shouting, realists. That's right. This is the difference in hope and fear, strengths versus weaknesses, excited about trying something versus a performance improvement plan. This is novelty versus obligation, resonance versus dissonant relationships. So here is the key. Given the data we've been collecting, in answer to this question that I asked you, we've done 2-hour interviews with a lot of executives who have gone through our executive education programs. We started doing this research in 2002. And what we found that every sample of data we collect, 80 to 100% of the stories had to do with somebody having a conversation with you, a parent, grandparent, maybe a teacher, a coach, or an early manager, in which they talked about possibilities, as a number of you said. They helped you to open up something. They didn't look at you and say, okay, you're a girl, you should be a nurse. It was, have you considered? Sometimes it's through role modeling, through watching somebody demonstrate or be in a certain way that just is very moving. The problem is, in these studies, we also asked the inverse question, which is, tell me about anybody in the last 2 years who's tried to help you. By implication, it hasn't gone as well. You know, any manager doing a performance review, any teacher, coach, therapist, cleric. And 67% of those stories come back. Well, they gave me data about how I'm coming across, and boom, they said they can help me with my problems, with my weaknesses. therein, I think we capture the essence of what it's like in these two emotional attractors. And as I'll explain momentarily, because of the way the stress system, the sympathetic nervous system, affects your perceptions and your cognitive functioning, that as soon as you start with a negative approach, as soon as you start with criticism, as soon as you start with data, which everybody reasonably gets defensive about, that the human organism starts to shut down. So in fact, if you start with giving somebody feedback about what they're doing or not doing, you actually activate the NEA, and at that point, the human organism starts to close down. It's one of the reasons why people who try to lose weight never will. It's negatively framed. You won't get there. Sustained desired change almost always starts in the positive emotional attractor. Why? Because if you start in the negative emotional attractor, it's a bummer. And again, people close down. They stop thinking about stuff. That's why any effort is not sustainable. We know this in medicine. Treatment adherence is abysmal for most maladies. If you're diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, the treatment adherence, the degree to which patients do what their doctors or nurses say they should do to get better, is about 50%. It's 50% in the U.S., it's 50% in Pakistan, it's 50% in Europe. Patients of orthopedic surgery, you break an ankle, you have knee replacement, treatment adherence is about 50%. And what my cardiothoracic surgeon friends and students tell me is that treatment adherence for coronary bypass surgery is about 20%. Now, why is it so low? Because look at the way physicians and nurses try to get you motivated to change. They say, well, you're a type 2 diabetic now. Your A1C level is 6.9. You have to exercise more. You have to lose weight. And you have to eat certain foods and stay away from other foods. And then they go on to say, and if you don't, and your A1C stays up there, we're going to have to start you on sugar suppressants. And if that doesn't work, we're going to have to go to insulin. And then if that doesn't work, we'll have to go to higher doses. And then if that doesn't work, chances are you'll have neuropathy and the nerves in your feet. We'll have to amputate your feet. And then we just start amputating up your legs. Isn't that motivating? Doesn't that make you want to do these things? And the answer is no, it doesn't. Because basically when we try to scare people, we close them down. So it feels a little counterintuitive. Because most of the time when we try to help someone, we actually are trying to fix them. We see what they should do, and we're telling them how they should change. And how do they react? Like somebody's being a bully. And by the way, constructive criticism is still criticism. It's NEA. It closes people down. It doesn't matter what your intent is. So sustained desired change in all of these research studies starts in the positive emotional attractor. A person opens up the possibilities. But it doesn't end there. We need both of these. I call the being in the PEA state, the psychophysiological state, thriving. Flourishing, some people call it. In the NEA state, that's surviving. And we need both. I mean, if we didn't have the NEA, you wouldn't have been able to wake up this morning. And you're going to have to solve some problems during the day. You need the NEA for that. But to thrive, to flourish, to be creative, to be open to new ideas, you need the PEA to learn, to change. So what I'm suggesting, beyond suggesting, I'm saying we need both the NEA and PEA in our lives. But because negative emotions are so much stronger than positive, not better, just stronger, for good ecological reasons, to create a counterbalance, we have to have a higher number of PEA moments in any given day than we have NEA moments. Otherwise, we're shrinking psychologically, cognitively, emotionally, physiologically. Barb Fredrickson says we need 3-to-1 ratio of PEA to NEA in teams to be effective. John Gottman says it has to be 5-to-1 in loving, stable marriages, PEA to NEA. to have a marriage continue. And if it's less than five, there's a 67% chance people will get divorced legally or just stop loving each other. Our research, which I'll describe in a few minutes, has shown that in coaching, you need like a 2 or 3 to 1 ratio. Now, why does this happen? Well, let me stop by summarizing. So what we're saying is, coaching to the positive emotional attractor, which is what helps people open up to learn and change, we use the expression coaching with compassion. We use compassion in the Confucian sense of benevolence or jin or caring for others, which is both hedonic and eudaimonic. It's caring for people who are suffering and caring for people who want to grow. But this is very different than what most of us do when we try to help someone, which we call coaching for compliance. We want them to do what we want them to do. And the fact is that it arouses people's negative emotional attractor, anywhere from mildly to extremely. So the question is, if you want to beat people up, if you want to get revenge or vomit on them, coach for compliance. Even if you think it's for their benefit, doesn't matter. It's how they feel it and experience it that's key. If you really want them to open up to learn and change, you coach with compassion. So, why does this happen this way? First of all, we're all hardwired neurologically to pick up on the emotions of others. Happens through a network I'll describe in a few minutes called the empathic network. The only people who can't do this, by the way, are people with some degree of autism spectrum disorder. And despite some of our hypotheses, some faculty's hypotheses that faculty colleagues in finance may have a high proportion of these people, that isn't really always true. I'm assuming there aren't any finance faculty on the call, so that's why I could take a swipe at them. But at any rate, Murray's laughing. Now, the thing about this hardwired picking up the emotions of others, according to Joseph Ledoux's work, it's happening in 8 to 40 thousandths of a second. This is deeply unconscious. And by the way, it's happening positively or negatively. And there's no neutral here. I mean, we're infecting people all the time. And if you're in a position of power or helping in a helping role, you're more infectious than others. Now, what is it you're infecting them with? Among other things, whether or not you're feeling stress or renewal. Now, stress, I'm not going to go through all the medical part of here, but within milliseconds, when a stress episode starts, which could be annoying, like your cell phone dropping a call or your computer not booting up fast enough, your body secretes 3 crucial endocrines, which are both neurotransmitters and hormones, epinephrine, norepinephrine, to shunt blood from your distal capillaries to your large muscle groups in your arms or legs to fight or flight. By the way, it also moves blood from networks in your brain that are not conceived of as critical to the functioning of the organism. And corticosteroids, in particular cortisol, by the time it enters your bloodstream, it's shutting off your immune system. That's why people who are in positions of power or helpers get ill so often. They are literally more vulnerable to all of the microbes around us. And crucially, cortisol stops neurogenesis. It stops the conversion of stem cells. In the adult brain, those over 26 years old, the stem cells from your hippocampus and your olfactory lobe are eligible to become new neurons. You're going to lose 85,000 neurons today. If you don't replace a certain number of them, in no time at all, your brain starts to have this spongiform quality that we see in all top seeds, Alzheimer's or dementia patients' brains. That's called neurogenesis, the conversion of these stem cells, neural stem cells. The problem is cortisol stops neurogenesis. So all that's going on, and you don't feel very good. You feel off your game. Then somebody says to you, well, where's the report that's due Friday? Mildly. And you start to feel, if you don't say, what's it to you? Which outside of New York is a defensive response. So what that means is that we begin to see things as potentially threatening that may or may not be. Why is it that the frequency of use of social media, including email and texting, is directly proportionate to stress, tension, anxiety, depression, and even, sadly enough, in our university campuses, an increased number of suicides among freshmen? It's because social media of all forms and electronic mediated communication puts us on alert all the time. The neurological studies make it very clear that you literally go into alert defensive mode every time. I mean, who looks forward to a tweet or a Facebook posting? Nobody. It's almost always defensive. Now, if all this was going on, how come everybody's not dead? This is why. Because your body, your autonomic nervous system, has another part to it that ameliorates the effect of all of this activation by the sympathetic nervous system. So if you see a baby start to laugh, or a golden retriever puppy roll in the grass, or a kitten play with a ball, you start to get a smile and this positive feeling wells up inside, and you're actually releasing two different endocrines now, primarily oxytocin in women and primarily vasopressin in men. These are vasodilators. Now, they don't move your blood from your capillaries. They move them, your blood to your capillaries. Your blood pressure goes down because your blood is traveling. It's estimated about a mile further under this state. You feel warm. Your pulse rate drops. Your breathing slows down, gets deeper. And it's in this state that your immune system kicks into high gear. It's in this state that the biomarkers of a healthy immune system, immunoglobulin A and natural killer T cells, are in their strongest position. It's in this state that repeated published studies have shown that you are at your cognitive best. You can handle the most complex ideas. You're the most creative. You can multitask the most. It is in this state that neurogenesis occurs. It's in this state that you feel elated, lifted, or joyful. Happiness is a little bit of a confused emotion, and it's not consistently related to this state, but sometimes it is. So the point is that we really need to enter this renewal state or parasympathetic activation state multiple times in every day. And if we don't, we're not kind of interrupting the things that go on. And if we don't do that, the stress of coaching or helping others will, over time, make us not sustainable. Now, there are many activities, which I'll go over some of them. For me to put them on this list, I have to read at least 5 published studies in medicine or psychology that shows this kind of clear effect for both males and females of any race or culture. We know that meditation helps. We know that yoga helps. We know that Tai Chi helps. We know that exercise helps if it's modest. We know that prayer helps if it's to a loving God. And we also know that feeling hopeful about the future really helps. That's why it's not good to watch the news. We know that having a loving, long-term relationship really helps. So it doesn't work the same way if you just go out and find somebody for the weekend. It's the durability of the caring. We know that helping people in the community who are less fortunate helps. We know that helping the elderly helps. I like to suggest to my students that helping elderly professors helps. And we know, and this we've known in published studies since the 70s, that having a dog, cat, and in some parts of the world, horses or monkeys really helps. Because it turns out it's the stroking or the petting that sets off the parasympathetic nervous system in you. Your companion feels it through the emotional contagion. Then you feel it back, and you know you're having a whole moment here. We use these to characterize how to get into this and break the cycle of stress in our 2005 book. But after that, since around 2009-10, enough published studies came out about laughter, joy, and playfulness that they've earned a spot on this list. And then just 2 years ago, I saw the 5th neurological study saying that a walk in nature actually activates these things. So I don't know what those moments are for you, and there probably are other things that aren't on the list. I only have the generic ones. But here's the key. You want to have multiple episodes throughout the day. So if you only had 60 minutes to go into renewal, which is ridiculous, you have to do it more. But if you only had 60 minutes in a day, it's much better to do 4 15-minute doses spread throughout the day than 1 hour at lunchtime. And while I was saying this to my patients back in when I was doing the alcohol and drug treatment work in the 70s, I now have the empirical evidence in a paper that Dan Goldman and I and Udayan Dar and Kalu have done, in which we are able to show the paper is being revised, getting submitted to another journal. But we had three separate studies to show that the variety of things you're using for renewal are just as strongly, if not slightly strongly, more strong in their prediction of sense of well-being, caring, empathy, reduction of distress, tension, etc. And it also predicts engagement and career satisfaction. So we have a sense that this is really important. Now, what this means is you can't just do this at home. You have to do this at work. And by the way, because learning happens in the renewal or the PEA state, this is what we should be doing as faculty for our students. So let me talk about a couple faculty practices that you may or may not like that are absolutely absurd, because what they do is produce more stress. Tests. If you give a test to your students, just be clear, you're using this method of evaluation for your convenience. You're not doing it because it's the best way to assess learning. Because actually in the psychology of learning, we know that almost everybody, when they have a test, crams. And now we know from a number of published studies that the more people cram, the faster they dump. It's a complete loss, delete of that knowledge. Actually, two of our colleagues at a top 20 ranked MBA program in the US showed 28-year-olds, full-time MBA program, after their first required course in accounting, they retook the same final exam. And these two faculty were able to show that the half-life of knowledge was 6.5 weeks. We know that and here's another grading on a curve. Excuse me, Murray, I'm sure you don't because you're an enlightened dean, but there are deans and promotion committees that evaluate faculty as to whether or not you have a distribution of grades, which again is an absurd process because it assumes that learning is zero sum and it creates extra stress, in this case on the faculty member. So one of the things that we have to do is ask ourselves as faculty, how can we do things that not only engage our subject matter or the relevant technical skills, but how can we do things that engage our students in a way in which they're excited about what they're learning, not drudging through it? Now, what we're saying as a result of the wide set of studies we've done is that whether you're formally coaching or helping, which is what we wrote our book about, helping, including coaching and being a physician, a therapist, a parent, whatever. But the question is, we shouldn't embed those conversations on trying to fix a problem. The context for the conversation should be a person's dream or the quality of our relationship. Because if you frame the whole conversation as address a problem, you're stuck in the negative emotional attractor. You're wallowing in the negativity. So what we're trying to do in coaching...
Can you actually see me, do you think?
No. I'm sorry? Okay. So what we're actually doing is trying to help with these gold stars when we're trying to help someone, help with their vision, their dream, help with their relationships or their strengths. And we do it by activating these green stars of moving them more frequently into the PEA. Now, we've got all these longitudinal studies, behavior change studies at WebEd, which we've been publishing, showing a huge increase in emotional and social intelligence as measured by people's behavior, not self-assessment. Now, why is this so powerful? When I and others studied above average MBA programs in the 80s and 90s, we found that a typical full-time MBA program and part-time MBA program has about a 2% improvement on these things, and then it atrophies after 2 years. And training programs in industry and government studied by the Consortium for Research on Emotional Intelligence showed that the best, the most rigorously published studies of training in government or companies, government agencies or companies, has an 11% impact and then it atrophies over time. Yes, we're getting an atrophy in our studies out 5 to 7 years at around a 50%, but that's starting from a much higher rate. What do we do that's so different? First, we spend the whole first third of our course on helping people develop, whether it's in graduate programs or undergraduate or exec ed, on vision. The whole first third of it's on vision. And then we have people, after they write out a very comprehensive, holistic vision, we have them spend an hour talking with an individual coach who's trained in more PEA than NEA approaches to talk about their vision. Then when we start doing what other people are doing, giving feedback on 360s and coded audio tapes of critical incidents or videotapes of simulations, assessment centers, etc., that's fine. It works out in that sequence, but it starts with the PEA context of the person's dream. And then we also, by the way, reinforce it by getting them to do more peer coaching, which with a little bit of training helps them stay a little bit more in the PEA. So let me talk a little bit, because I talked about the hormonal. I didn't talk about the neurological. This is the results from a key study that Tony Jack, who's a case, a neuroscientist, did, and which he showed. We know that the task positive network, which Tony calls the analytic network, the anterior cingulate cortex, parts of the prefrontal cortex, are crucial when you're trying to solve problems, make decisions, or focus. There's another major network in the brain called the empathic network, technically the default mode network, that is key to you being open to new ideas, scanning the environment, and being open to people. What Tony showed in this study, with a much larger sample size through fMRI than usual, very precise arousals, is that these two networks are not, there's no overlap, and they suppress each other. People have been writing about that for a number of years, but nobody has measured it, I think, quite as precisely as Tony did. Now, that means every time we activate the analytic mode, we suppress the empathic mode. That means that every time we go into analysis, we suppress a person's ability to be open to a new idea. Let that sink in for a moment. That means every time you activate and increase stress, you're shutting the person's mind down to new ideas and to people. Now, you clearly need both of these networks in doing any professional work or managerial work or helping. I mean, if you're a teacher or a coach, you want to use the analytic network to understand your student or patient or client, but you also want to use the empathic to understand how they're feeling. So we contend that you really work these two neural networks like a toggle. And since the neural networks are one third of the PEA-NEA, we're expanding that to be really a demonstration that we want to help people through going back and forth, but spending more time ourselves in the PEA, as well as bringing our client, our student, our patient back into the PEA regularly. And we actually put it to a test in fMRI, and we did it by with putting undergraduates into 30 minutes of coaching to their dreams. If your life were fantastic in 10 years, what would it be like? Or 30 minutes of NEA coaching. How are you doing in your courses? Are you doing all the readings, doing all the assignments? Not very negative, but all guilt-inducing. And we were able to show 3 to 5 days later, randomly sequencing which went first, randomly assigning whether Masood Khawaja or Angela Passarelli. Masood is on the faculty of the medical school at the University of British Columbia. Angie is on the faculty of the College of Charleston. Whether or not, and each one did the PEA or NEA, and what we're able to show is that the PEA activated the lateral visual cortex back here, where your brain lights up when you're imagining things, and the PEA was active in the posterior cingulate cortex, nucleus accumbens, key parts of the empathic network. The NEA activated parts of the anterior cingulate cortex, which is related to the analytic network, and it wasn't a pure one-to-one because it also activated part of the medial prefrontal cortex back here. That's a part of where it's in the empathic network, but it's where you feel self-conscious. We got very excited by this. We won an award at the Academy of Management. We got recognition at the Society of Neuroscience. So while we were waiting for it to get actually published, come out in the journal, we did another study. Now we ratcheted up from 20 subjects to 50, half males, half females. We did older. We did seniors rather than sophomores. And we also threw in another twist. Instead of just one PEA and one NEA, everybody got the NEA. Some got one PEA. Some got two PEAs. Some got three to see if there was a dose effect. Fortunately, as we presented at certain AOM meetings, we were able to replicate the earlier findings on the basic contrast. But fascinating, we found, and this replicates the work of Eisenberger for years, that two or three PEA sessions to the one NEA activated the ventral medial prefrontal cortex, the part in yellow down here that's part of the empathic network, that is the brain's one crosswalk to the parasympathetic nervous system. Massoud even showed in his thesis that a lot of the things that affect treatment adherence in the medical literature are mediated by the degree to which the patient sees that his or her physician and they have the same vision, not goal, vision. So a lot of this has to do with vision and dreams. We know that when people set specific goals, it does not motivate them to change, except for those people very high in achievement motive, and they don't really care about the patients or the innovation or the clients. They just like the numbers games. But for most people, specific goals puts them into the NEA. There is neurological evidence showing this. And as soon as they go into the NEA, their brain starts to close down. For example, several British psychologists did a study using nose sprays of epinephrine versus oxytocin to activate stress versus renewal. And they were able to show that people's peripheral vision, which, you know, if you're not a pilot, you don't know this, but if you stare straight ahead and keep moving your hands back till you just can't see them, that's your peripheral vision. Mine is right there right now. It's about 180 degrees. You know, it's usually somewhere in that range for most people. Well, under the epinephrine spray, the stress, it goes down to 30 degrees. Under the oxytocin, it goes back out. That's the kind of issue that happens. Another group did the same kind of nasal spray issue with pictures of acquaintances, like from Facebook. Under epinephrine, the stress effect, they right away did a visual effect. Oh, that person's a Pakistani, that person's Caribbean, that person looks Irish. Under the oxytocin, the renewal state, that person has a great sense of humor. That one's a really good dancer. That one is great in tough situations. People went below the surface to something about the person. Now, when we think about a person's vision, the enemy is not the real self. It's the ought self. It's the vision that everybody else keeps trying to push on us. They're coaching for compliance. And we know this works, visioning works so powerfully. Every gold medalist talks about their visioning work in the Olympics, before the Olympics, excuse me. We know it works with improving your golf game. We know it works with music and with studies. And yet, how often do we engage personal visioning in our classrooms? How often do we engage personal visioning in corporate training? We don't. And in the process, the tasks, the stress just shrink us. So rather than going into, I'm going to skip the Portuguese poem. Shared vision, by the way, is now showing in a lot of these different published studies to be key to effectiveness in everything from acquisitions to family business to IT to physician managers to engineers to banks. Bank executives to community college presidents to think knowledge workers. So I'm going to pause now and just ask if there are some questions that people might want to ask.
Yeah, Richard, let me ask you the first question. Thank you very much. This was really great. And let me ask you the first question. You know, I want you to imagine a middle-level manager like a dean, and you're under some sort of pressure from your president who's something like that physician, you know, that if you don't do certain things, you might get amputated, okay?
Yes, right.
So how in working with your team or your people or your faculty, what would be the first thing you would advise that dean to do to arouse more PEA than NEA? what would the first thing that that dean should do?
The first thing would be, and I would do this in a conversation, depending upon how intense their degree of negative arousal is from their own management meetings, I might have to invoke some deep breathing exercises just to help the person kind of calm down. And I do know a lot of people who actually start either their classes or coaching sessions that way. But then I would immediately try to move the person into some PEA. I'd say, look, you know, we'll talk about the issue that you're running into with the provost or the president in a few minutes. But right now, let's shift a little bit the context. Let's talk about why you're doing all this stuff. And let me not talk about the immediate right now. Let's talk about 10 years from now. What would you love your life to be like? And by trying to help the person get into this positive dream state, what we should do is do two things. One, flip their current hormonal state. But the other is give them a context for why they're doing it. So, for example, one of the issues, I mean, most people walk into a dean position not because the pay is that great, as you know. They walk in because they want to help people learn. They want to create more curiosity. They want to have their faculty add knowledge to the various fields. And they want to inspire students. And sometimes in some schools, some universities, they want to create public access. Those are the parts of the noble purpose in being a dean that is easy to forget amid your fundraising targets and the budget issues. But that's what sustains you, not the other. So even though it's not easy, the issue would be to try to help the person get into doing that. You were very innovative at Liverpool when you were the dean in creating and nurturing a number of very, very intriguing and very successful, both financially and educationally, master's programs. I thought that was a part of the fact that in those days, I don't know if you still are, but you meditated at least twice a day. And, you know, we had talked about this in a number of cases that, you know, and then you and Liz would enjoy wine with dinner and, you know, you have a number of laughs. So, when you're in a dean's position, you have to remember that it's not just about whatever is being thrown at you right now. It's the bigger picture. It's not easy. I'm not saying it's easy, and it's not like you can turn on a dime. But the more you practice that in the conversation, the more it might help. The more a person who is a dean might walk, be thinking as they're walking to the provost's or the president's office, why they're into this whole thing. Or when they're walking back, not to think about all that crap that just fell on their head, but think about the big purpose, and then later go back to the crap.
Thank you. Richard, there's about six questions. Would you have time to?
Yes,
You can look at that now. I think it's easier for you to manage the script, okay? On the question, can you see the questions? On the Q&A button? The second button from the left.
Yeah, no, I got it. Right. I'm just clarifying something because somebody said some people on the autism spectrum disorder can be deeply empathic. Yes, that's true. What I was clarifying is that the toggle back and forth seems to only be not easy to happen with many of the people in the autism spectrum disorder because of a dysfunction in the empathic network. So how can you provide constructive criticism that is not perceived as negative? You can't. Keep it to yourself. You know, I mean, seriously, you have to ask yourself, do I want revenge? Do I want to exercise my dominance? Or do I want to motivate the person to learn? And if you want to motivate the person to learn, then keep the next criticism to yourself until the person gets to a point where they genuinely come to you and ask for feedback. And I don't mean they're saying, oh, yes, you know, thank you. You're my department chair. You're my dean. What should I be doing differently? Because then people are going like this. You know, they're not really asking for feedback. But if you can get somebody to a point where they genuinely say, you know, I'm trying this out. I'm trying to take a different approach in writing about this. Could you read this and tell me what you think? And if the person genuinely means it, then that's when negative feedback or constructive criticism can be very useful. Let's see now. Question, what kinds of measures of behavior do I use? If you meant in the change studies, I'm using measures of emotional, social, and cognitive intelligence competencies. How does engaging the student in the PA help teaching ethics? Ooh, that's great. Most of the people think teaching ethics is teaching people right from wrong. Sorry. Almost everybody knows right from wrong. Even psychopaths know what's right and wrong. They just don't care. So the issue is, if you want to teach ethics, and we had a public, we had a paper, Tony Jack and I and Kylie Rochford and Shannon French, had a paper that was published in the Journal of Business Ethics a few years ago saying that the real key to teaching leadership ethics is to teach to people to move back and forth between these neural networks. So the way to teach ethics in leadership or to students is to put them more regularly into small group activities, to put them into situations where they are experiencing diversity of thought or emotion. So what you're doing is you're moving from the analytic mode to the more emotional perceptive mode, and that by toggling back and forth, you now make it possible for a person to not just get exposed to a different idea, but to consider it. In most things that are called ethical breaches, they were people thinking expediently about how to be more efficient that caused the breach, whether it's the mistake in Deepwater Horizon or the admissions scandal in Volkswagen. These were not done by people who didn't know right from wrong. They were done by people who were letting the analytic mode dominate over their thinking. So, could the PEA be useful in discussions with students who are unhappy about their grades? Possibly. By the time you get into discussing a grade, it's like a performance review. You know, performance reviews are useful, like performance feedback is useful, but they're not development. So anytime you try to have development happen at the same time as an evaluative mode, you're killing both. So what I'd say is, my suggestion about the use of grades in that form of evaluation is to be really clear about the criteria up front. I mean, many of us have the explicit criteria for what constitutes a good, bad, or indifferent, or meets expectations on each one of the assignments or actual grade levels listed in the syllabus. But if we have them indicated in ways that look standardized, then if a person doesn't do well, they should know that they didn't do well. It's not you having to interpret it for them. Sorry, there's a lot more to that, but right now I want to be able to get to some of the other questions. So if you're in a career counseling setting and a student just lost their job, how would you get them into the PEA? Empathize with them for a minute or two, literally, no more than 2 minutes, because then you're just enabling. You know, it really sucks. It's horrible that you lost your job. Let's think about the big picture for a minute. If your life were absolutely perfect 15 years from now, what would it be like? Where would you be living? With whom, if anybody? What would your physical health be like? What's your spiritual health? What are you doing for the community in terms of giving back? Now let's talk about job, work. What kind of activities are you doing? What does it mean to you? Ask them to do that, to step back and see the big picture, because that's what they need. They shouldn't be looking for a job. They should be looking for the next step in a career that will lead them closer to their vision. And sadly, very often, because everybody under tension narrows their perspective, people end up using jobs as a way to explore what they really want out of life when it's kind of a waste. Somebody asked Eusebio if they can get to see the slides. I'm okay with that. Do you have a way to post them?
It'll be at the MED.
Oh, they'll be in the MED.
Yeah, they will be on the MED website. So
okay.
I'll make sure that we'll send everybody a link to that as well.
Good. Okay? Good. What readings do you recommend for integrating play and humor into coaching and the workplace and even into the classroom? I don't really know too many. I was referring to some of the scientific studies that say that humor really is characteristic of more effective managers and leaders. We do know that helping people laugh is a nice thing to break up the intensity in a classroom. As Murray knows, I start most of my classes and most of my lectures with music, but I use upbeat music that makes people want to move just as a way to get them in touch with a different part of their brain. Interpersonal exercises helps. Things where you can use humor just to alleviate and break some tension. I really don't know anybody who's written about that in a kind of way to help guide it. Maybe it's an issue of just observe in various other meetings you're in or dinner parties or social settings, what's going on when people laugh, and then see if you can replicate it. Of course, in this day and age, you have to be politically correct, so that adds to some of the tension. Let's see, two questions. As a coach, do we need to communicate with our coaches, our clients, about our PEA approach? I would say yes. I don't do it up front because that's too analytic. And up front, you want to get them into the state and then help them with it. I also think that sometimes giving people some readings to reflect on, exercises are key. In our new book, at the end of each chapter, we have a number of reflective exercises that you could use with yourself or with your clients or students. We also have a number of discussion guides for conversations in study groups or in classrooms. Are there some undisciplined people that are likely to rely on negative emotions to take actions? Yes, I think there are, and I think they tend to be bullies with other people. I think they tend to be isolated. People don't want to hang around them or follow them. And one of the dilemmas is I think they just atrophy themselves away. So people who are excessively negative, if they're a student of mine or a client, I try to bring them into the PEA. But otherwise, what I end up doing is just kind of leaving them to stew in their own negativity. I'm afraid I'm getting dinged from my next webinar that is supposed to start shortly. Classroom interactions. Experiential learning really helps. And experiential learning, as Dave Kolb said, is everything, including lectures. But the idea is varying it. Because just like you want to vary the kind of learning style that each student has, making sure that there are concrete moments, reflective moments, abstract moments, and active moments in each class as well as in each course, I think to the extent that you realize that some of the active and some of the concrete moments are interpersonal. And, you know, putting people into interviewing people in the field or using small team or trio projects are very good ways to help people stay alert and learning, regardless of whether or not the subject matter is operations, marketing, finance, or organizational behavior. Okay, so the question about tips for coaching online. Use good video. Actually, we have a modality study coming out, and it depends on how facile your client is with electronic media. We're discovering in middle-aged, mid-level managers in various corporations that don't have a lot of experience with video conferencing, that they prefer the telephone to a video interaction on coaching. The paper on the outcomes, as a result, is still being prepped for submission. The name of the new book is Helping People Change, available at your neighborhood bookstore if you order it. Certainly Amazon has a very good price. It's published by Harvard Business Review Press, and my colleagues, Melvin Smith and Ellen Van Osten, I've been working with for 20 years with Melvin, for 28 years with Ellen. on the research as well as on training coaches and teachers and with all sorts of different audiences from undergraduate to folks in their 50s and 60s. It was an act of love of writing this book, and you'll read a lot. We kept the research into these kind of research spotlights. We used a lot more human stories from people that were either helping, trying to be helped or not, as a way to illustrate the point. So hope you do it. It makes a nice Thanksgiving Day gift. And certainly you can give it as a Christmas present to your president of your university or provost. That's for deans, Murray.
Thank you.
Any other kind of final comment before I'd like to make my closing comment?
Well, Richard, listen, I want to thank you. Before you find your final comment, I really wanted to thank you, particularly on behalf of a MED, and a, want you to you know, participants know we'll be having another, at least one, maybe two, next semester. So keep looking out for that, and we will make the tape and the slides will be available on the website. Send you a link. Okay,
good.
Richard, thank you.
Okay, my closing comment: we have initiated a study a year and a half ago on the competencies of coaches assessed against multiple client outcomes. Nobody has ever done this study before. And all of the certification movements use the word competency in them, but none of them are empirically based. So with the sponsorship of ICF and CCCE and others, I am trying to do this study. We need more coaches. If you're interested in helping and you've been a coach for at least 2 years and you're fluent in English, we'd like you to come to this URL. You'll read the letter of consent, read the details on the study. It takes about an hour and 5 minutes of your time, including some peers, not coaches, but other peers, to get a 360 on you, and then 1 to 3 of your clients to fill out 20 minutes worth of stuff at the beginning and about a year later. So if any of you are willing to help out with the research, we could really use some more coaches. So here's the last point. We have a very special gift from our gods, life. It's not a dress rehearsal. We should be moving closer to it. And really, if you asked any of the 6.5 billion people alive who live under conditions of oppression, they would say, please go for it. Don't waste it. So I've gone over 18 specific things you can consider doing to increase your movement toward your dream or those of your students, clients, patients, family members. But the last one is remember the moment. Remember the moment when you were a kid before a holiday or a vacation. Remember in high school before a big exciting sports game or your first date. Remember the publication of your first paper, your first IPO if you're a major donor to University of Baltimore. Remember your birth of your first child, your first marriage. These are very special moments. And when you remember, you well up with this positive affect. You know what? You become positively infectious. And when that happens, you start to find yourself in your families, in your communities, and at work, coming together and doing things before that you never thought were possible. Thank you. God bless.
Thank you, Richard. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much. We close this seminar. The recording and materials will be available at the MED website. I posted the link. Richard, once again, thank you so much. It was a pleasure. And we'll see you next time. Goodbye.
Great. Thank you. All right.